Hello, and welcome to the resumption of Millennial 2017. This is episode number 58, and this is with Frodi from the Scanza Forum. Welcome to the channel, Frodi.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Hello, and thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Before we proceed, I should say that there are going to be four hangouts tonight: Scanza, and then Sitsitsion from Germany, and then possibly, and then Monokulttuuri from Finland, and then possibly V. I think he's from Romania. I can't remember. I'm not sure if he'll come on or not, but he wants to debate me on something, so maybe that will happen, or maybe not. And then finally,
You have a
Descent
busy night
Report.
then.
So, oh so four, possibly five hangouts, and that's what's coming up. So in the meantime, hello, Frodi. So you should briefly introduce yourself to people who might not have heard of Scanza or Radio
Yes,
Men Afraid, of course.
exactly. Yeah. Should I just tell you about me first, and then go into the Scanza, maybe?
Yeah, well, we'll just say for now that you do conferences and you also do a podcast, and
Exactly. Yeah,
that's
I do. I do the Scanza
yes.
Forum. It's a Scandinavian event. We've done events in Sweden and in Norway so far, and we're also going to do things in Denmark. That hasn't happened yet, but we're going to. And then I also do a weekly podcast called Mennefrego, which is in Swedish regularly, but we also sometimes have English-speaking guests, and you have been gracious enough to appear on our show, which I
Yes.
appreciate, of course.
Yeah.
Myself, I have been involved in some way or other in nationalism since the late 90s, I believe. I've been interested in these things basically my whole life. I grew up in a very small town on a little island in the Faroe Islands, actually, which is 100% ethnically homogeneous, with everything that includes. So it's very little crime, very high social, what do you call it?
Cohesion and
Social
trust.
trust. Social trust, yeah. So basically, you don't have to lock your doors, and you don't have to lock your car or anything like that. And then when I was a child, I moved to Sweden, and I saw the contrast. I moved to a town that has a very high proportion of immigrants, and immediately I felt the contrast. I felt alienated, and
Where were these immigrants from?
I just well, immigrants in Sweden are Middle Easterners. That has changed over the years. Many immigrants came from the Balkan, Yugoslavia, and so on during different periods of the 20th century. But in the 90s and later in the 2000s, they started coming more from Africa and from farther away, so to speak. So the contrast became even greater over time. But it was very noticeable for me even at that point, because yeah, I came from a very sort of homogeneous place. And I didn't particularly like what I saw in Sweden. And of course, as a child, you just react. But I didn't put things into words, of course. But then, when I was about 15, I would say, I started reading about politics. So from 15 to my early 20s, I started. Well, this was the 90s, so you know the nationalist movement was what it was. I started reading people like William Pierce and David Duke, Nietzsche, Schopenhauer, also Vari Viken. That's maybe that sounds a bit weird for people today, because now he's mostly known as a pretty eccentric YouTube guy for probably many of your listeners.
Yes.
yeah. But back then he was, well, obviously he started out his career as a musician, but he also wrote a lot about Nordic mythology, and the value of his contribution there. I mean, he's obviously not an academic. He doesn't do a lot of footnotes and so on, but he is an artistic guy, and the benefits from what he did was that he went back to the sources and did his own interpretations and everything. So right or wrong, he basically forced people to engage with the sources and go back to their roots. And that inspired me a lot, because I've always had, since I was basically a child, I've always had a very strong connection to the Icelandic sagas and the Nordic spirituality, the Nordic religion, so to speak. And that was strengthened also by reading his interpretations. So I did become involved in some way with the movement back then. But, well, it was quite different from what it is today. So I have not really been a public figure. Yeah.
Yeah. How would you describe it back then? Was it more spiritual? Would that be accurate to say, or is that specifically to do with Vary Vikernes?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say that. It was just more subcultural. It was very subcultural. It was, you know, the skinhead movement and everything. In Sweden, that was a pretty big thing back then. I don't know how familiar you are with William Pierce and so on, but there were intellectuals, of course, but the movement was very, very sort of subcultural, and it didn't have ideologically. I think it was probably very sound, but it didn't have a good ethos. It didn't have an appeal to normal people. That's probably the biggest problem it had, because
yeah,
you know.
I think that William Pierce tried to fight against that, but I think it was a losing battle at the time. There needed to be a huge cultural change, I think.
Yeah, that's probably true. William Pierce was an extremely intelligent man. I have the greatest respect for him, and I would probably say that still today, one of the best things you can do to get a sort of education on these matters is to listen to his American Dissident Voices, the radio show. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I don't think so. No.
No, he did a radio show basically since the 70s in West Virginia where he lived.
Wow, I wonder American, if that's archived.
It is. It is. It is. It's since 75 or something until 2002 when he died. He did it weekly for all those years. It was locally broadcast in West Virginia, but it was of course recorded and people bought it on cassettes and so on. And it's on MP3 now, so you can download it, which I did when I was young and listened to every episode. And it was
so you really
very enlightening.
You very much threw yourself into this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the whole movement that he created, I mean, he didn't have a good feel for what appeals to normal people. So he just bought into the whole skinhead thing and tried to promote that. He did a lot of weird things with video games about ethnic cleansing and weird documentaries and so on. But I mean, the intellectual content was always very much on point. And he was basically the one who discovered the political use of sociobiology, I would say, probably very early on, which was right. Sort of a branch of science that came out in the 70s. So he was a scientist. He was a professor of physics. So he was very much scientifically based in everything.
The only other professor of physics that I can name off the top of my head is Angela Merkel.
Is she that? Okay. I didn't know.
Oh, no, she was she's a doctor. She's a doctor.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, that influenced me a whole lot. Reading William Pierce and also William Gailey Simpson and people like that, and Nietzsche and Schopenhauer, and that put things into context. When I first saw the huge problems with immigration in Sweden, I just reacted as a child, basically, but then I just, you know, saw that it was wrong, but didn't know how it came about or how it worked, you know, or what to do about it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. To be honest, I think that is reflected in the general European population and even the white population in America as well. I think we all, everyone just didn't know what to make of it when it started. We reacted to it as children, just baffled, and just got along with it, like children do, you know? And over the decade, a more sort of, well, at first there was a sort of aggressive reaction to it, unfettered, untutored. And then over time, an intellectual framework built up for us to be able to object to this, for us to be able to handle and to understand what was going on. What is going on?
Yes,
Then from that you get a more mainstream friendly culture.
Right, you're breaking up. Can you hear me still?
Yes, I can hear you.
Now you're back. Now you're back.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So I was saying that over time, an intellectual framework built up to help us to understand what is going on. And then from that, it starts to seem completely sane and normal to object to it. So then
normies
start getting on board, or at least not normies so much, but people who are not the kind of people who are attracted to subcultures. You know, and I've got nothing against them. I'm one of them myself, but I do know that we're not the best people to represent something. You need people representing a movement who are pretty mainstream, you know, who don't seem kooky or off the wall. And I think that's the stage that we're approaching now, because we've done this work the last 50 years to get to this stage.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because when I first saw your videos it's less than a year ago, actually. It's when you were attacked in the British media, I believe. And I think Greg made a radio show about it. So I became curious and I checked it out. And I was very impressed, because you possess something that people in this movement normally don't. It's a sort of a relatable personality, if you like. And I think a lot has been very scientific, very autistic, if you like, over the years, and we have lacked the sort of just relatableness of
I think
ordinary
so.
People, likable people. Yeah,
I think so, and that's not a sort of criticism of the autists. It's just a fact.
No, you know, it's a fact.
We do need to be relatable. Because that's ultimately, you know, most people are not going to be persuaded by science. They're going to be persuaded by seeing another human being talking to them, communicating with them in a way that they can understand, which is usually very, quite emotional, actually.
Mm. You know? Yeah, that's also why YouTube videos and podcasts and so on are effective in ways that books and just text cannot be, because it brings the human into the game.
Absolutely, that, and that's what YouTube is so good at. It's, I mean, this whole thing recently with the the kraut drama with the skeptic community, It's hilarious because what you see is a collision of all these different personalities and these characters.
I'm not aware of that. What's that about?
Oh gosh, I don't need to go into it in depth. It's just it's been a huge argument between the alt-right on YouTube and another community on YouTube who are very anti-identity politics. Are very they think they're centrists. They're actually leftists, but they think they're centrists.
Right. And, okay.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to be debating one of them. Well, this guy V in a few hours, if that does happen, that's one of them. But anyway, they sort of pride themselves on being centrist and not falling for ideology on either side. So anyway, the point that I'm making is not about them really. It's just that YouTube caters to this. I mean, there were so many streams about it, like 2-3 hour long streams talking about this drama, and it is ultimately an interpersonal drama. And it's not, you know, it was originally about ideas, but it quickly became about people. And it was hilarious in some ways, just for the absurdity of it. But the point is that obviously on YouTube you get to know people, and that I think is a very social thing. It's very enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, it is.
Millennial is a good example of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You know, classical teachings in oratory and eloquence, even going back to Aristotle, they focuses on three modes of communication. You know, ethos, logos, and pathos. And logos and pathos, they are, well, to the listeners who are not familiar with that, logos is just logical arguments, and pathos is just emotional conviction of the subject you are addressing, so to speak. But ethos is about the communicator himself. It's about his credibility, if you like, because if you don't have credibility, whatever you say will be rejected, no matter what evidence you can present for your case. And ethos can, of course, be something like authority. For example, a Nobel Prize winning chemist who has authorities talking about chemistry or whatever. But normally, ethos is just about being relatable, coming across as a person that normal people can relate to, and that thing has very much been lacking in many proponents of nationalism through decades, basically. And I think you bring that to the table very much. I mean, being a huge admirer of William Pierce and so on, I still see that problem, that it's very much about the logic, but I don't think he would come across as a sort of relatable person today. But you sort of personify a very strong ethos in that way. So I think you come across as very relatable and likable, and I think that's a game changer today. That's a whole new
ball game. And I mean, thank you. That's very kind of you to say that. I don't want this. I don't want to sort of make this about myself. I think ideally there would be other people as well, and I think they are emerging. And that's the whole game plan here. I don't want to be just the only one who's relatable to the public. Ideally, there should be many. And there are others. I mean, I'm not saying I am the only one, but I want there to be as many of us as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you say, you know, I mean, this is why it's so ridiculous what they did to me, the newspapers. It was obviously dishonest. They were obviously lying. They were obviously twisting my character. And I think anyone who read those articles and then looked at my YouTube channel would know that. But of course, the danger is that most people don't they will read the article and then not look at the YouTube channel. So they'll just think, okay, it looks like a villain, looks like a bad piece of work. So that is a danger. And we have to be very careful about enabling the media to do that to us. Now, obviously, they'll do whatever they can. But there are certain... There are certain phrases in my old videos that I wish I hadn't used because it enabled them. You know, they can justify the claim that I hate women, for example, which is just fucking ridiculous. But they can justify that claim on the basis that I once said I wouldn't blame any man for wanting to punch a particular feminist that I was talking about.
Right.
And, you know, it was because she was infuriating. She was just an awful woman.
And that's a very feminist thing to say. You want to treat her like a man because you would punch a man who behaved badly.
Yeah, of course. But if I do that, then I also hate her. So, you know, you can't win, really.
No,
But yeah, so I think, and this is something, because I started as a complete amateur, having no intentions to become a representative of anything at all, and also having no knowledge of how to do that. Therefore, I said some things that in retrospect, I wish I hadn't said. But of course, newcomers to this scene can learn from that, and they'll hopefully be more careful than I was. I mean, honestly, most things that I've said, the vast, like 99% of the things I've ever said on this channel, I would stand by. But it's a matter of phrasing.
Well, it's only natural because you know, podcasts and conversations, you don't plan every detail ahead and you just say things, and that's pretty, it's human, it's normal to say things that you might have formulated differently if you had the chance or whatever.
Absolutely. And that's a huge thing about Hangouts, like, you know, anything live. I'd like to do more of my stuff live streaming next year, but the danger with that is that you do say something and then think, oh shit, that could be totally misconstrued. And you know, you make yourself vulnerable. It's very easy, because in a life, especially in a conversation like this, you feed off each other's energy, and it's fast paced compared to a monologue. So there is a danger that you just say something unadvisable.
Well, I just want to say also, in connection to the whole ethos thing, when we're on the subject, that's also one thing that's quite ridiculous about the very heated debate that has been about the woman question, you know, women participating in this movement or whatever, because there's one thing that there's one quality or property that women have in an infinitely greater, to an infinitely greater degree than men, and that's social intelligence, and the sort of feel for what works aesthetically. In one way, it's not just that, you know, women are aesthetically good to look at, it's also that these weird movements that attract weird people attract mostly men, because men don't have the ability, to the same extent that women have, to discriminate between what looks just insane and what looks normal, no matter how, you know, autistically stringent the arguments are.
Yes. It's really unfortunate, because, you know, these are good guys, they don't mean any harm, but they're just not good at communicating.
That's actually a valuable contribution that women can make, because, I mean, through the years I've had mostly just quite normal, non-political girlfriends and whatever, and if I show them a sort of subcultural magazine that white nationalist men have made, they just think it looks fucking weird. And that should say something, because these are just normal people, and it's opinions from people like that can sort of guide you in what works and what doesn't work.
Yes, absolutely. I think, and also they tend to be more outgoing. You know, this is what I was saying in my video about the thought issue, the malice aforethought. I was saying that, you know, 3 years ago, it was the movement was largely men who were despairing at the state of society. They were frustrated, and I think, like it or not, a community of without women will have despair to something, unless it's a military unit. You know, then there's a clear purpose, clear structure, and people are constantly doing things. But if it's a community of men that don't have a militaristic structure, then I think there is a huge tendency to despair, because in the back of your mind is always that suspicion that we are not, if there are no women here, then there's something wrong with us. There's something fundamentally unattractive about us. Now, obviously, you can say you shouldn't worry about that. You should worry about the cause. But people aren't like that. You know,
that is the cause. That is the fucking cause, right? That is the fucking cause to attract normal people and build an actual community. The cause is not just to outline theory and write a book about it. The cause is to actually build a social movement that includes normal people who can actually change society and build basically a parallel society that can attract high quality normal people. It's quite obvious. We do need normal women and normal men. A movement just consisting of men is a symptom of something being wrong. That's my point. And I totally agree with people saying that, well, it's just a plain observation that women don't have the same capabilities of creating ideology or whatever. I mean, there are some exceptions. I would say Savitri Devi has made valuable writings and so on. But I mean, normally speaking, women don't contribute the same thing with writing political theory. But they have a different job in creating actual social communities, and we need that as well.
Because men and women are different, as we on the same side of politics are aware. I mean, it's ridiculous to say, well, they're not coming up with original ideas, or they're not. I mean, fuck off! is that what you expect of them? I mean, you're just setting yourself up to A, be disappointed, or B, hate them for not coming up with original ideas. So again, it's the self-fulfilling, self-perpetuating resentment of women, to be honest.
Yeah, and coming up with very original ideas. I mean, the very criticisms against the problems we have today have been written hundreds of years ago, and in many cases thousands of years ago. Like going back to Aristotle, he pointed out many of the problems that are current today. But is it wrong to point them out again, or should you just rely on the hope that people will start reading Aristotle's Politics? It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous attitude.
Sorry, yeah, I was just scanning the chat there. Yes, of course it's a ridiculous attitude. Most people are not going to do that. This has to be a real thing, a real movement in the real fucking world that actually gets things done. And I think, again, and I've said it, you know, we did talk about Thoughtgate in the earlier millennials, and I don't want to keep going on about it. I do think a lot of it is, as you said, this used to be a subculture. The whole nationalism thing used to be a subculture. And I do think there are people who would secretly, they don't want it to succeed because that would be a new situation. They want to remain underdogs, embattled, and getting beaten all the time by our opposition. Well, sorry, but I just don't want that. I want the survival of my race, and everything else is secondary to that.
Yeah, there is a sort of masochistic streak in some people. They want to be losers, and they think it's very beautiful to be losers and feel like martyrs and whatever. But I actually want a better society for future generations. That's the top priority.
Yeah, indeed. One other thing that somebody mentioned in the chat, and it did occur to me, is that women are often the most ideological. And Orwell wrote this, I think it was in, I think it was about Catalonia. I've forgotten the title of it, but he wrote that women are often the most ideological. And it was in 1984. He was talking about the Red Sash Brigade. Mm-hmm. That is truth. And because I don't know why that is. I think it's because women are sort of predisposed to maintaining a status quo and strengthening a status quo. And looking after a situation, perpetuating it. And so, they can get quite nuts about the ideology to quite a cold extent. But, you know, that's a danger that we can deal with when we come to it. And to be honest, I would rather they were too much into this than not into this at all. You know, if it's a choice between one or the other.
Yeah, I mean, a case in point is, of course, Savitri Devi. I can't think of a more fanatical national socialist than her. it goes beyond what people normally do.
Yeah, someone's used the phrase, women are more autistically conformist. I think that's the word, conformist. They simply are.
Yeah,
it's a... It's but that is not a worry for me. You know, I'd I don't think it's something we need to deal with just now. I think for now, we just need to deal with getting them on board in the first place. And I think as once we've done that, and I think we're in the process of getting there right now. I mean, I think we're sort of stepping over that threshold at this very moment. But I think once we've done that, they will start converting each other and so on. The danger, of course, is that they will then try to water it down, some of them. But then, well, that's we can deal with that when it happens. You know, it would be crazy to shoot ourselves in the foot and say, well, we don't want them in at all if they're going to, you know, because, you know, anyone could water it down. Any guy could do that as well. Indeed, many have tried.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh, yes. I think oh, yes.
Yeah. So you go.
Yeah. No, I just agree that many people have, you know, joined these movements and tried to water the message down and trivialize and relativize different points. But I mean, that's what we need ideology for. And I don't think the risk is any greater with women than with men. I just think that it's a measurement. It's an indication that something's wrong when a movement just attracts one sort of specific segment of the population.
Yes, I agree. So let's get back to your own story. And
right.
So, what I don't know what point in the timeline we got to, but you were early 20.
Yes. Basically, that's when I formulated most of my thoughts, and I basically came to agree with a lot of what Nietzsche said. About, I mean, his criticism of Christianity is basically that when Christianity came, there was a paradigm shift in the spirit, in the mind of Europe, and then when Christianity died, when religion died, when the belief in God died. That paradigm was still in place, and that gave rise to things like Marxism and liberalism, and they operate in the same paradigm, in the same metaphysics, if you like, in the same framework that Christianity created. And that made me realize that, you know, no amount of just plain conservatism will ever work in dealing with the problem, because we need a fundamental transvaluation of values. We need a completely different value system than we have today. And that's basically where I'm still at. I think we need a complete revolution, a spiritual revolution, if you like, an intellectual revolution, a moral revolution. Because I don't think the moral framework that the West operates in today works. It just creates nihilism, and it just makes us. Yeah, commit suicide or makes us let other people kill us, basically, because they have other moral systems. And that's basically why I came to where I am today, where I believe that an organization like the Skanza Forum and other similar things around the world are necessary, because I don't believe that populist politics will do the trick. I think we need something more profound than that.
So you're looking for a new elite. You're trying to build a new elite.
Well, it's sort of has to start, I guess, with an elite, but it's not really. The elite aspect of it is not really what's central to me. I think the central thing is to go to the root of the problem. And that's why, you know, revolutionary politics is necessary. It's not it's not gonna do the trick to just go to populism and believe that Trump or Nigel Farage or Putin or whoever is gonna save us, because we need a new framework totally. And you know, William Pierce, he wrote an article, Why Conservatives Can't Win, where he just states the case that when a conservative and a sort of revolutionary socialist, communist, whatever, goes to the, when they go to the negotiating table, and the conservative has kept half of what he had originally, and the communist or the socialist has taken half of what the conservative had. The conservative still thinks that he's been successful because he has kept some of what he had, you know.
Yeah, but that's a good point.
Yeah, so it's sort of a death by halves all the time, and there's really not much left to preserve in our mentality or in the sort of public culture of today. So I do think we need something very much more profound. We need to get the confidence back to assert our own interests unapologetically. And I don't think we can do that by accepting the rules set out by our enemies, basically.
Absolutely. Well, the first problem is that we can't advance our interests if we don't believe that we exist. This is the first big thing that our enemies have established, is the concept that groups are just social constructs, so there's nothing to protect.
Right. Yeah, and that's also that's a necessary result of multiculturalism, because if you have a sense of your own history, if you know your own culture and the achievement of your own ancestors, if you know that you come from ancestors who created the culture of Knut Hamsund and August Strindberg and Snorri Sturluson and Edvard Munch, and another person is from Somalia and his ancestors did other things, you will notice the difference, and you will notice that you have different ancestors, and these things are ethnic and biological, basically. And people need to just accept that and stop apologetic about it.
Yeah, there's a meme that very, very well illustrates what you're saying, which is that you've got a young blonde woman and a black guy at the bottom, and they're obviously in a relationship. And then all the other pictures, on one side, it's all the achievements of Western man, classical music, space exploration, and so on. And then on the other side, it's Africa. And then the caption says, there's a reason why people are staring.
Yeah. I mean,
I know
we have
it's
to
cruel.
Stop talking about. No. It's not cruel. It's just matter of factly. We have to stop talking about these things like they're a dirty joke. You know, like, I'm gonna tell you something. I know this is politically. I'm not a racist, but, and you know, all that jazz. So what we need is just to assert our own interests and be very unapologetic and be very sort of just reject
just nice
the whole moral frame. Yeah, sure, be nice, of course. But
asserting the truth and being totally unapologetic. I saw a thing, I think I talked about this in one of the previous hangouts. It was a radio show in Britain called I think it was LBC, and some guy phoned in saying that he was alt-right, or he identified with alt-right ideas. He believed in them and so on. And then he proceeded to just apologize for every single one.
Yeah.
And he was asking this leftist woman to accept him as he was, but then he proceeded to denigrate what he was. I mean, it was just pathetic.
This is right,
And I mean, what he was as an identitarian or nationalist, not what he was as a white man. He sort of proceeded to apologize and sort of ask her for approval on all of these ideas. When, I mean, it was agony for me to listen to, because I thought, you're just asking her to destroy you. You're asking her to basically tell you she has no time for your ideas whatsoever, and you'd better shape up and get with the program. You know, that is the worst possible way that you could approach this. I would say, if anything, you should do the exact opposite and treat them with a degree of contempt. Treat them as the person who has not. I mean, it would be nice if you could treat them as equals. And sometimes you can. It depends on their attitude, to be honest. If they're being bitchy, then you should treat them like an insolent child and just talk down to them. And
I mean, we do have the moral high ground, and we should recognize that, and we should act as if we have the moral high ground, because we do. I mean, there's nothing. People have been told that it's very racist to look out for your own, and it's very immoral to look out for your own family, basically, more than you look out for someone on the other side of the planet. But I mean, I can't think of anything more immoral than to neglect your own kids or whatever on behalf of complete strangers. That's
This is another thing. It's a sense of ourselves in time. As I was saying in the speech at the Skanza Forum in Oslo, if you don't have a sense of your group as something that exists in time, like in the past and in the future, then you're screwed. Because there is nothing. Protect. It's just a bunch of random individuals in the here and now who happen to have something in common, and they happen to be together, you know, but it doesn't mean anything. Whereas as soon as you've got multiple generations of that group who are recognizably of that group, then you've got something to protect. You've got something to believe in, because it becomes sort of eternal in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like the... I think it's a quote by Osama bin Laden that if a person sees a weak horse and a strong horse, he instinctively chooses or is attracted to the strong horse. It's like if you show any weakness in this game, you are going to get beaten, because our enemies are not as moral as they like us to believe.
For the sake of it, I've always wondered about that quote. I think it's true of politics, but I think in other terms, I don't think it is true of white people. I think that his people probably do that. They probably choose the strong horse and think fuck the weak horse, or literally fuck the weak. But I didn't intend that. But I think in Europe, a lot of us would see the weak one and think, okay, that's something for me to look after. I can be kind, and I can help heal something and strengthen it up, you know. I think he was speaking off the Arab mentality, to be honest, when he said that.
I think it depends on context. It depends on the chooser, if you like, the person who's going to choose between the weak and the strong horse. If that person himself is in a very strong position, he can afford being.
Oh yes,
yeah. Stupid.
And of course, and that's the problem now. We think in Europe, we think we're so strong that we can afford to. Help everyone else, and you know. What that's going to do is destroying our strength, you know, depleting it. But I know I understand the quote, and yes, I think in terms of politics, of course, people are attracted to strength and confidence. They're not attracted to the guy who's apologizing for being for having the political beliefs that he has. That's just pathetic.
And that's going to be even more true when we go into harder times, because when you have affluence and when everyone believes in the sort of Schlaraffenland that you can just everyone can have anything they like, and the government will take care of you and everything will be okay. When people start seeing that's not how it works, they will look to people who have confidence and who sort of reflect that in their confidence and strength.
Yes, I think that just now that is actually starting to come apart. You see, the reason that people don't look for strong politicians right now, when they damn well should be doing so, is again that they think everything is fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in Sweden and Denmark, especially Sweden, I think the public seem to be completely unaware that their country is dismantling. It's being dismantled right under their noses. They don't seem to realize that. It's the same with the Germans.
Well, sort of, but still, they have no one who actually stands up for them. I mean, if Sweden had a politician with the same attitude that Donald Trump had, he would be prime minister or state. I don't know what you call it in English. The Statsminister, the prime minister of Sweden.
Prime minister.
Yeah.
Because that's
what people need, because they feel that having attitudes, negative attitudes about mass immigration, is wrong, and when that is confirmed by people supposedly standing up for Swedish interests and these people being apologetic about it, it just confirms that it's immoral or wrong or whatever. But if you have a more sort of a fuck you attitude about it, that's going to attract people. I think it does.
I think it does. Yeah. You know, what we've got just now is a culture of in politics that, mm-hmm. that sort of celebrates and promotes blandness, and it promotes mediocre politicians who don't really believe in anything, and they can play the game and it works. But people want someone who believes in something. They want a character as well. Again, it comes back to the social thing. Nigel Farage and Donald Trump, I don't know about other countries, but those are both men who have personalities. They're not just, it's not just the ideas they're espousing, it's also that they are distinctive men, individuals.
And I think they actually attack their opponents.
Yes. Yes, yeah, indeed. Donald Trump more than Nigel Farage, to be honest. But they're both very willing to just go straight for the kill, which is...
Oh, yeah. I mean, Nigel Farage in the European Parliament, he's pretty ruthless against, you know, Herman Van Rompuy and all those those ridiculous figures there.
Yes, you're right.
And people love that. People love that.
Yeah, those videos get loads of views on YouTube. Because this is a thing. This is another thing about YouTube. You end up with there is this catalog of political moments, and it's a wonderful, because you get these little clips like 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 20 seconds, and it is very fun. You know, I think it's good for politics. Honestly, I don't really. I don't worry about this. You know, some people do. Like, I've heard people say that it reduces politics to sound bites and all that. But I think, well, that's ultimately how we handle these things nowadays. And we do know what it all means. We do know what's beyond the sound bite. So it's not like we're becoming. Yeah,
sorry, I just got someone knocked on the door.
Yeah, can you speak to the phone?
Sorry about that. It's just someone knocked on the door.
Oh, that's fine. That's
still
fine. Yes, I'm here. So, so I suppose to round off, we should talk about the Skanza Forum and Radio Menefrego. So,
sure.
Yeah.
The Skanza Forum was. That's fine. The Skanza Forum was founded. I founded it in early 2017. So we've had so far two events. The first event was in Stockholm in May, I believe. And we had Kevin MacDonald, we had Greg Johnson, we had Guillaume Durocher. And then we had one event in Oslo, where you were kind enough to appear as well. And we had Mike Enoch and Greg Johnson and Olav Thorheim, a Norwegian linguist and physics PhD. And Lauritz von Gildhausen also gave a talk there. And talk...
This was really good.
Yeah,
I mean, they were all very good. I enjoyed all the speeches there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm very happy about them. I the Oslo event was filmed by Red Eyes, so you can find it on their YouTube channel, I believe. And there are just two talks from the Stockholm event on YouTube. I'm not sure about which ones are up on YouTube quite right now. The Oslo event was. And we had a very good Q&A, which was very much appreciated. That was actually very good. A friend of mine, he said that when he saw your talk from the Oslo event, he said that if he had like one talk to show to his normie friends, that would be it. So I think that was very much appreciated by the listeners.
Oh, that's nice to know. It was put together, as I said at the time, it was put together in a hurry, but people seemed to like it, and I think it went well.
You had to fill in for a was supposed to be another speaker, but you accepted to talk on very short notice. So that was also to your credit, of course. And the next Scanza Forum, so people can mark their calendars for April 7th in Stockholm, and we're gonna have F. Roger Devlin. He appeared on the Men of Frego podcast a few weeks ago to talk about the woman question. Basically, he has a PhD in philosophy. He's written about Kojève, the Hegelian sort of philosopher, but he's most known for the book Sexual Utopia and Power, which is about the effects of
feminism.
The results of feminism and sexual liberation, basically. That interview from Anne Frego was very much appreciated. So I think people will be happy to see him in Stockholm. Then we're going to have Mike Enoch. Most of your listeners probably know who he is. He runs the
Right Stuff.
The Right Stuff, and the Daily Show. And actually, when I asked people in Oslo to raise their hands if this was their first event, about 65, 70 people, 70% of the participants raised their hands, and most of them actually came into the movement through TRS and work by Mike Enoch and those guys. So they do excellent work.
Yes. Yeah, it's very different from the kind of stuff that you and I do, but it's very the American side of things. But yes, it's good.
It's very much, when I first found out about them, I think they were not white nationalists at that point. But they have become a sort of a huge force in our movement, actually. And they do a very good job. Then we're also going to have Jared Taylor, and probably most of your listeners will know who he is as well. Have you had him on the show?
Yeah. Oh yes, oh, yeah. A week ago. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Everyone knows Jared Taylor.
Yeah. Good. Good. He is basically the grand old man of white advocacy today, I would say. He is one of the most eloquent speakers for our cause, and he has written several books, and American Renaissance has been active for I don't know how many years, but I've been following it for many years. He's a great writer and a great speaker. So and I think it's the first time he appears in Scandinavia for an event like this. So the Scandinavian fans will be very happy to hear him, I believe. So
definitely.
Yeah. So April 7th will be the next Scanza Forum. And then I also do Mene Frego, which is a weekly radio podcast in Swedish together with my colleague Jonas Dejär. We do it mostly in Swedish, But we also sometimes have English-speaking guests. So, of course, then it's in English. You have appeared, and John Morgan has appeared, and Devlin, and Mike Enoch, and several others. So, and I think you will provide the links to that as well?
Yes, they're all in the description.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. Yeah, so what kind of
topics do you cover on Radio Menefrego?
Well, we do a lot of current events. Menefrego is basically a phrase from Italy. I think it was first used by at least in political context by Gabriele D'Annunzio, the poet and writer and politician who sort of was a, you could call him a proto-fascist, I believe. And they used the black shirts in Italy used that. It basically means I don't care. It's a sort of very sort of illustrates an attitude that we'd like to not be too timid about things, I believe. So we like to speak freely about everything, but we usually focus on current events and start from there and go into sometimes more ideological and philosophical and cultural issues. So we do like an hour and a half each Sunday, usually in Swedish. And then we have, if something interesting happens, we have a guest on, and sometimes we invite guests just to talk about culture and politics and so on. And we started this summer. I think we started July. So we've just done it for like 6 months.
Yes, I can't remember. I think it was the very first episode that I was on.
No, but you were pretty early, I think. It was like within the first month or two. I think August or something.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't remember when it was. I think August rings a bell. That seems right.
I think so.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Well, I think this has been a nice introduction to you and your ideas and what you do. So I hope that people do attend the Scanza Forum. Will there be another one in Norway next year?
We've just scheduled one for now. So, and well, the those three speakers that I mentioned, they are, well, just the first. We will have more speakers as well, but those are the first three that are confirmed so far. So we'll
high profile.
Keep up. Yeah, we'll keep updating that list. So I think, and also before I started the Scanza Forum, I organized a couple of other events with Ricardo Duchesne and Matt Tate and Kevin MacDonald and Greg Johnson and so on in Stockholm as well. So I think we're starting to get used to the sort of organizing these types of events. So I think it's going to be very good. At least the last one was very much appreciated by our visitors.
Yeah, I had a great time, and I do hope, I want there to be many, many conferences going on around Europe. And so the more organizations there are that do conferences, the better. I think it's a great social thing. It really helps people to, you know, get out from the computers and, you know, meet each other. And it's a fun thing to do. You know, I love giving speeches as well.
And you're very good at it. So I hope you'll come to a future event as well. I think it's, you know, the content of the speeches is of course very important, but even more important is the social thing, that you actually meet people, because we are social creatures, and what we need is the confidence of being surrounded by other people who can sort of confirm what you have observed and what you feel about the whole state of affairs. because just to have it in theory isn't really enough. It's very easy to get burnt out by seeing the things you see and reacting and writing online, but all the flesh and blood people that you interact with are very critical of you, and many people find that extremely frustrating. So coming to an event like this is an oasis for them, and I very much enjoy organizing events like this, and you know, meeting lots of it's encouraging to meet the sort of young, very intelligent, high quality people that come as well.
Yes, yeah, that's another thing, that you're not going to be surrounded by idiots at one of these conferences. People that I've met tend to be, you know, intelligent, educated, sensible. It's just a pleasure, really.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. I mean, without tooting my own horn, is, you know, in the old movement, in the olden days, in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, when I went to events, I could feel that people were very much, there were not a lot of intelligent people around then. So you sort of felt that it was a bit weird interacting with them. But nowadays, I'm just blown away by the top quality of the new people coming in. And like I said, the Oslo event had like 65-70% of the people who were there. That was their first event, and they were all of a very impressive quality. So I was positively surprised by that.
Oh yeah, and there's a sense that we're not just there's a sense that we're waiting to do things. You know, like I can imagine that people who attend these conferences will in the future have organizations of their own. They'll be doing, I don't know, fitness programs to help other people get into shape. I can imagine that they'll be entering politics. I can imagine that they'll be starting their own businesses. I can imagine that they'll be lobbying, that kind of thing. So it's terrific, really.
Yeah, and you know, in the audience has several university professors, well-educated, highly educated people who are engineers and lawyers, and you know, so it's like people who have potential for becoming influential in our society. That's the type of people we get, and we get hundreds of them to these events, and they're networking, and that's what's gonna cause real world change in the long run, that people actually network, get to know each other, and actually do things in the real world. And that comes from events, meeting at events like this. And people call me all the time asking when the next one is. So I know a lot of people will come.
Yeah, great. Well, as I say, that's why I hope that there are more conferences. I'm going to one in Estonia in February. I'll be speaking at that. And other than that, that's all I know. But hopefully there will be more conferences next year, and I'll give more speeches.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I'll certainly organize more than one during 2018. I just don't have any date.
Oh, no. I'm not putting the pressure on you. I'm just saying in general, I hope I wouldn't want to impose that on anyone. But I just hope that the scene grows. I think it will. I think it will.
Oh, yes, yes. It grows both in quantity and in quality. And that's so encouraging. You know, I've heard a lot of people being a bit depressed by people sort of going away from the movement after, you know, the numbers exploded in our ranks election, and now people have started to disappear from the movement again, and some people are discouraged by that, but I mean that's a very normal procedure, because when there is a very strong populist movement, you attract people who are not really as fanatical as yourself. Yeah, they're not committed, you know, to politics, and they'll go away, and but they'll still be affected by what they have seen and learned. So it hasn't been for nothing just because people, you know, are not very active anymore. It's to be expected, and that's
yeah. I mean,
we still have grown.
Yeah, I haven't seen people moving away. I mean, maybe that has happened, but in my channel, it's just grown steadily throughout this year. But I think what has definitely happened is that we lost momentum and direction after the Trump thing. And then infighting and all the rest of it. But hopefully that will. I've got a feeling that we're now moving beyond that stage and, you know, more optimism again. I certainly hope so.
I think so. And I think, you know, the whole alt-right, that brand, basically, and the whole the memeing and the everything, the trolling and everything, that brought a lot of that brought our issues to the attention of a lot of people. And I think it was for a lot of good, but it's certainly not enough. So now I think we're just going to go back to doing more sort of long-term ideological and socially more creative work, you know, creating social circles and so on.
Yes, and building for the future. I mean, that's the crucial thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So these things come in waves, you know.
Yeah, the memeing and all that might come back in 2019 because of the Trump 2020, you know.
Oh, yeah.
MAGA 2020. So I wouldn't be surprised.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, it's still the case that the left cannot meme, so it's a weapon that they can't counteract.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's done a lot of good, but yeah.
Yeah, sorry, you go.
No, go ahead.
Oh, well, I think it's just a general thing that we did lose momentum, but that was bound to happen. It was always going to happen. And actually, in my, in February, in my Stockholm speech, that I said that it was happening and it was going to keep happening because we need, you know, after a massive high like the Trump election, obviously, you don't know what to do next, and there is a sort of lack of direction. And then, of course, Trump started to become a more disappointing president. So, you know, that certainly got people down. I think that was in April with the Syria thing.
I'm actually a bit surprised that people were so surprised by that, because, I mean, Trump plays the game. He's definitely not our guy, but the effects that I expected from his participation were basically the things that he brought up in the presidential campaign. So it's basically the debates and the left making fools of themselves. But from the actual day-to-day politics, I didn't expect anything basically from him. And I think that's basically what we've seen, because the actual effects from the debates, you know, from the issues that he brought our issues to people's attention and legitimized them, because now an American president has actually talked about the problems of immigration. And immigration to Europe, the problems with Merkel, and, you know, that's a good thing.
Yes, definitely. There needed to be someone like a proper politician who spoke against the insanity of what Merkel has done. And he's really the only one. So, I mean, Farage has commented on it, but not to the same, with the same, you know, strength. And, yes, I was glad. I mean, Merkel, I mean, we could talk about Merkel all night. I think that the just madness of what's happened in Europe over the last two or three years. But, I think everyone knows what we would say.
I think so. But I mean, like the speech he gave with the venomous snake, the thing that Trump said about that. Did you hear that? It was pretty early during the campaign. He gave a speech where he talked about where it's a lyric from a song where a woman takes care of a venomous snake, and she pets the snake and the snake bites her and said, "You stupid woman, you knew all along I'm a venomous snake." he used that as a sort of an illustration of the problems with immigration.
See, you know, in Europe that could be done. He could be done for hate speech for saying that.
Yeah.
You know, you're saying that you're dehumanizing Muslims and likening them to venomous reptiles. So, you know, it's just another example of how ridiculous it is that we have to rely on people in America to say these things. What can you do? But no British politician would ever say something like that.
No. And I do think that has changed a lot of attitudes about these things, and it has legitimized our criticism, because it can't be that bad if the American president says it. You know, it can't be completely illegitimate. It can't be, you know, Holocaust, Nazi, whatever kind of words they want to throw at us.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I mean, I don't know what he'll do. I'm worried that the wall will not be built. I'm worried that it will all just
I don't think it will.
Up against, yeah.
Go no, ahead. I don't think it will be built. I don't actually expect anything from him. The Jerusalem thing with moving the embassy to Jerusalem, and I'm not surprised at all. And I don't think people should trust democracy very much. I don't think people should have this naive belief in democracy. I think people should understand that this is a reality show on TV, and the benefits we can get from it is the message that's being put out by the politicians. So if Nigel Farage says a good thing, that's a good thing. If Donald Trump says a good thing, that's a good thing. And don't expect anything more from them. I think that's the right attitude to have. Because yeah, I think so. Basically we're going to need more fundamental change than just, you know, elect a new president or whatever. I think this is a struggle that's sort of comparable to a religious sort of revolution that takes hundreds of years in some cases.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it will take that long for us, because I think there simply isn't that long. It's that we just simply don't have that length of time. I think this is like, we're looking at 50 years.
Sure. But I mean, the attitude we should take to it is not the attitude of a political party, but more as a more profoundly revolutionary movement that wants to change the very foundations of society, because that's what we're going to need if we're going to make it at all.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, that's sort of similar. Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, on that, I think that's a nice note to end on, unless there's anything else you'd like to say.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. All right. Okay, well, that was Frode from Skanza and Radio Menafrego. So I think this was a very good hangout. Enjoyed it. And there are three, possibly four more on the way. The next one is with Tsitsit Sion. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm probably not. But they can give the correct pronunciation when they're on. Okay, so thank you, Frode.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a huge privilege to be on your channel. I'm a great fan of your work, and I hope to meet you again soon in person as well.
Oh, that'd be great. Okay.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Thank you for appearing, and thanks to everyone for listening. I'll be back soon.
Okay. Take care. Bye.